Just stand on a beach in Oregon a time or two and you quickly realize the wind seldom stops. Not only that, there are clear sunny days when you want to flee the beach because the wind makes you feel like you're getting sandblasted. In short, that's a lot of wind, and at the moment, it's not being used to generate electricity. But a recent report from the National Renewable Energy Laboratory looks into feasibility and cost of generating wind power offshore from Oregon. Walter Musial is the lead author of the study. He's principal engineer and leader of the offshore wind research platform at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, which, Walter, I presume you call NREL a lot?
Yes, we'd call it NREL.
Okay. Well, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
So NREL and a couple of other entities took part in the study process. Lay out how things were conducted here.
Yeah, we started, we were several authors, but this study was funded by the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, who has a strong interest in understanding what kind of issues they might encounter if in the future offshore wind does develop in these areas, especially looking in this study on the coast of Oregon. We also engaged an advisory committee that was made up of mostly local folks that who could help us understand some of the some of the local issues that might arise. This committee was comprised of people from the Oregon Department of Energy, the Department of Land and Conservation and Development, Pacific Marine Energy Center in Oregon State, Bonneville Power Administration, Portland General Electric, Northwest Power and Conservation Council, and the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. So we had a great diversity of groups from the local area, and they were giving us some advice as we went along and tried to do this study and identify locations where offshore wind could possibly have economic value and might not interfere with the local operations and uses that are currently going on.
Well, I describe the situation standing on the beach. When we're talking about offshore wind, how far offshore are we talking about and how much wind is generally out there?
Well, that will distance from shore will be decided by stakeholders that get involved later. This study, we didn't engage a diversity of stakeholders, but generally we looked at sites that were at least 10 nautical miles offshore, and this is really to avoid the obvious types of conflicting uses and visual impacts that might arise from putting things too close to shore. We looked at a strip of land that went along, or I should say open water, that was 10 miles offshore, but no deeper in depth than 1,000 meters. And then we were choosing locations along that band where we could do an economic study. So we weren't doing environmental studies. We weren't doing marine spatial planning in this scenario. We were just looking at, well, what would offshore wind cost if we were to put a large commercial wind plant at each of these locations. We chose five spots ranging from the northern border near Washington all the way down to the California border. So we got a diversity of sites that that helped us understand what it would look like from east, for going from north to south.
And judging by the charts and maps you show in the report, south of Port Orford, that site 5 in the study gets lots of wind on Oregon's south coast. I mean, can it be too much? Is there a sweet spot for wind generation?
Well, we didn't think it would be too much, but yes, this is a sweet spot. The further south you go in Oregon, the better the winds get. And this is a very interesting phenomenon that we found. The gradient of wind from north to south on an annual average basis was about 2 meters per second. And that makes a huge difference in how much energy you could generate. We don't think that there's too much wind there. We think that would be a very optimum area for putting wind turbines in from strictly an energy generation standpoint.
Walter Musial is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's from the National Renewable Energy Lab, and we're talking about a study of offshore wind in Oregon, a feasibility and cost study that he led. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Give your thoughts about what you'd think about having energy generation going on with windmills, maybe 10 nautical miles offshore. That's 6,000 feet per mile, isn't it? Nautical miles?
A nautical mile is, I think, 1.19.
Okay,
statute miles. Yeah, right. So it's a little more than a mile.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And Walter, what's the reason for considering floating wind energy generators? What's the ocean floor doing 10 nautical miles out?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Offshore wind is really taking off on the East Coast, and the technology they're using there is fixed bottom foundations, which means the water is a lot shallower there, and they can use structures that attach directly to the bottom. On the Pacific Ocean, the depths are much greater, so we need to develop platforms that are actually buoyant and moored to the bottom because the depths are so much greater. 97% of the feasible area in Oregon is too deep to put in these fixed bottom foundations. And in the areas where you could put them in, they're probably too close to shore. So we want to look at the technology that's developing now for floating technology that would allow floating offshore wind turbines on the West Coast. And this is true for not just Oregon, but for California and Hawaii as well, where we're looking at the same similar situations.
How far advanced is that technology of the floating wind generators?
Well, it's a lot less advanced than the fixed bottom systems, but we use a lot of the same technologies. In Europe, they're developing the floating technologies now. There's been several deployments, and there's a lot of projects that are in this pilot phase. So there haven't been any commercial size projects, and by commercial size, I mean something that's on the order of 500 to 1,000 megawatts in size, where you can power cities and things like that. We're looking at the first pilot stage project of 30 megawatts went into Scotland, for example, and that was put in by Equinor, a Norwegian oil company, and that project is doing very well off the coast of Scotland right now. And there's about 14 other projects of a similar nature that are going in throughout Europe. So we're watching that technology develop, and as it develops and as those machines are proven, assuming that they will be shown to be proven feasible, that will be the launch pad for commercial technology that I expect will start to be developed maybe in the mid-2020s. That's when we should begin to see the possibility of feasible commercial development in the Pacific Ocean off the United States.
So just the two offshore methods compared with each other, both in upfront cost and operational costs, is floating likely to be more expensive than the fixed bottom sites?
It is initially, because there's fewer of them and the technology hasn't been proven yet. But our projections in this report that we're talking about and in and what's being demonstrated is that the costs are coming down very rapidly. And because we're using a lot of the same technology, the costs will be very comparable in the end game when we get to commercial development on both sides. And that's what we're finding right now. They use the same turbines. They use the same electric cables. They use a lot of the same infrastructure. So there's a very close tie to what fixed bottom offshore wind is doing and what floating will do when it's developed.
We are talking to Walter Musial here on the Jefferson Exchange from the National Renewable Energy Lab. He's the lead author of a study on offshore wind site feasibility and cost in Oregon, or off the coast of Oregon, about 10 nautical miles. That's more than 10 regular miles, statute miles. You can join the conversation on the exchange with your cautions, your questions, your concerns at 800-838-3760 by phone. Email is jx@jeffnet.org. You'd mentioned improvements in technology and cost. I noticed that there was a report on the California offshore wind market in 2016, and it seems like even since that time there have been improvements in technology and costs.
Improvements, a lot lower uncertainty in projecting those costs as well. Some of the phenomena, just to give you a couple examples of why these costs the cost reductions are accelerating, turbine sizes are growing larger, faster than we had thought. And we were assuming 10 megawatt turbines in that California study that we did 3 years ago. And now it looks like 15 megawatt turbines are quite feasible. They're already being developed in the industry, and we didn't see that coming. Finance rates are much lower than what we had thought. Turbine prices in general, dollars per kilowatt, are lower. We're seeing the prices that are being bid in European markets are much lower than anybody had anticipated, and if the prices that are lower, then the costs are lower too. So we're seeing all that stuff come in, and that's all new information that we didn't have 3 years ago.
All right, so a big change just in a short amount of time. So what are we talking about potentially for what an array would look like out there? How tall would the towers be? How far would they extend below the surface? How would they be tethered to the ocean floor?
Yeah, so let's start with the turbine. The largest turbine available that's in prototype development today is being developed by General Electric. It has a 220-meter rotor. It stands I'll pass on the tower height. I can't remember right now, but it's about 500 to 600 feet above the water. Mm-hmm. So these are big turbines. Each of these turbines can power thousands of houses. One turbine can power thousands of houses, and they would be placed in rows and arrays off the coast. If it was a 12 megawatt turbine, you might say you were going to put in a 1,000 megawatts, you would have perhaps 80 of these machines lined up in rows, and they would be connected by array cables or wires. Big fat wires that connect each one. Those wires would be aggregated at a substation and then brought to shore on a large export cable that brings the power to a substation onshore where it can be distributed to the land-based grid. And that's probably the most simple way to describe it.
Okay, go
ahead.
The question was about you don't know how much below the water is that what you're saying?
The turbines would be on platforms that are buoyant below the water, mm-hmm. and those platforms would be moored with anchors to the mm-hmm. bottom.
All right. Now, in terms of getting the power onshore, there's quite a bit in the report about existing infrastructure, like undersea cables for communication and facilities onshore for electrical mm-hmm. Transmission. Mm-hmm. Does it seem like any part of the coast is better arranged for those sorts of things than others?
Well, we're as far as the existing cables are concerned?
Mm-hmm, yes. Yeah, or existing electrical infrastructure to tie into.
Oh, there's no electric infrastructure out there right now. We would have to build it, and one of the challenges is where to connect it on shore. Mm-hmm. In Oregon, all of the power that's being used in the coastal cities is being brought from east to west over the coastal range into those cities. There's no generation there, and so we would have to tie into substations that are out there, and probably there would have to be upgrades to those substations in order to basically bring the power from the offshore wind plant and then redistribute the power along the coast and back into the central part of the state. And there's a lot of advantages to that because the Bonneville Power, in fact, we're looking at this right now, Bonneville Power is trying to figure out how to and upgrade their land-based transmission system. If we reverse the flow toward the center of the state, we may be able to avoid land-based transmission upgrades that they're looking at right now. And we're doing a study. We're just beginning that study right now, but we'll be doing a study to see if there's any benefits that from offshore wind that might enhance that.
You know, as I looked, Walter, at the South Coast example, you could get a cable from offshore wind to the Gold Beach substation, for example. That's 32 kilometers of cable. Mm-hmm. That cable alone seems like it would be pretty spendy.
It's very expensive, yeah. Mm-hmm. Each of these projects probably cost over $1 billion to build, and that. But these are large power plants, and they it represents a large infrastructure that would displace a lot of the fossil plants that are currently feeding those areas. In Oregon, I should say, 48% of the state is powered by hydro right now, so it already has a lot of renewable energy in it. There's some nuclear, but then the rest of it is coal and fossil plants that could be displaced by renewable energy from offshore wind.
Let's take a call here. We have Mark in Redding, California. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Walter Musial from the National Renewable Energy Lab. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. Have you as yet given any thought to whale migration?
Oh, yeah. For that matter, other sea creatures that would have to move through the tethers and the other things that would be present. How much of that has been explored so far? You mentioned this is not an environmental report.
Yes. And whale migration is something that is being considered on both coasts. So there's a little bit of information. I think the biggest impact on the East Coast has been the pile driving. There would be very little pile driving in a floating type of a wind farm. So that part of the whale problem might be mitigated, but we would still have to be very concerned about the noise generated by construction. And so that's one thing that we worry about with the whales. As far as the operations are concerned, the whales probably are most the thing we have to worry about the most is the additional vessel traffic that would be out there that could potentially run into a whale. The turbines themselves are unlikely to hurt whales because the lines, the mooring lines, are very large, very tight, even compared to a whale, and there's no danger of entanglement with a mooring line or an array cable.
We have a question here, too, from Grumpy John in Grants Pass by email, who wants to know about why are you not considering vertical cylinders instead of the blades?
Vertical cylinders? You mean vertical axis wind turbines?
Yes.
That technology was developed maybe 30 years ago at a smaller scale. It has not been demonstrated that it can be scaled to the size that we have right now for horizontal axis wind turbines, and there has been no further development of vertical axis technology for offshore wind. It's been discussed a lot, and there's a lot of people that are still interested in it, but the technology that has been proven is a horizontal axis wind turbine.
Okay, so that's what we're looking at here. Again, it is called the Oregon Offshore Wind Site Feasibility and Cost Study. Walter Musial is principal engineer and leader of the Offshore Wind Research Platform at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, NREL. Obviously, a lot of other people involved in the process as well. And $1 billion is the basic price tag we're looking at now. Walter, thank you for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange with all the information.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It is the bottom of the hour on the Jefferson Exchange. We will be talking about prescription drugs coming up.